Right now, I'm very happy to introduce to you Sanjeev Berry. He is Amnesty International's Middle East Advocacy Director, here to talk to us tonight about the very grave and escalating violence situation we see in the nation of Syria. Sanjeev, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
I wondered if you would describe for our listeners who may not have been following some of the news reports about the situation in Syria after 16 months of civil conflict, and a report I just read today by the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights that more than 17,000 people have died in the violence since this uprising began in March of 2011.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the uprising began, or the conflict and the violence began when peaceful protests with regards to how some Syrian children were being treated by the prison officials and by law enforcement officials, were then treated with violence by the government, and that then escalated from there. And so while we can certainly call it a civil conflict, and in some parts of the country it's taking on those contours of a full-scale internal conflict within a country, much of the violence and much of the death toll is the result of the Syrian army and Syrian armed forces' crimes against humanity, in which there has been what looks to be an organized, targeted campaign of violence against civilian populations carried out by the government's armed forces. Now, of course, we're getting increasing reports of human rights abuses by different opposition forces or opposition groups, but the bulk of the violence remains to have been committed by the Syrian government's armed militias, armed forces.
Sanjeev, I'd like to talk about some recent developments. There was news that Russia announced they would no longer sign new arms sales agreements with Damascus, and I'm wondering how significant that is in terms of Russia softening their position on backing the regime of Bashar al-Assad, the Syrian president.
Well, I think there's two ways of looking at that certain new news development. One is that it shows that the Russian government is paying attention to global opinion, that they don't necessarily want to be seen as outright aiding and abetting the violence. But on the other hand, Amnesty International considers that statement by the Russian government to be pretty feeble. And the reason why is because they're not saying that they're going to be cutting off pre-existing military contracts or supplies or deliverables, and that's the real question. Not a decision to stop "quote unquote" new supplies and new armaments being shipped, but what about all of the pre-existing contracts?
So it means that they may not sign new agreements, but in essence, they may be following through on old arms deliveries contracts. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely, and that's the real challenge. Russia is Syria's biggest supplier and supporter in terms of weapons, military arms, equipment, repairs, replacement parts, all of those things. And so when Russia says we're not going to do anything new, well, I'm not sure what to make of that. It sounds pretty feeble because the Russian government has so many pre-existing contracts in place.
Sanjeev, we also hear reports about former United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan and his latest efforts to negotiate an end to the conflict in Syria. His efforts heretofore have not met with success, but he's got a new round of talks he's had with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, and he's also scheduled to talk with some opposition groups. Do you have any hope that Kofi Annan can make a breakthrough here?
I think the global community and the global human rights community is certainly deeply appreciative of Mr. Annan's efforts to try to bring an end to the violence. You had mentioned 17,000 names. On our more conservative side, we've received the names of 12,000 people who've been killed, but the total number could certainly be far higher. And with regards to Mr. Annan's efforts, we all certainly want to see him succeed. The challenge, though, is that so far that latest news report, at least from what I've seen, hasn't given any specifics. And the underlying problem is that the Syrian government continues to wage war through its armed forces and through these allied Shabia militias against the civilian population. And that's why Amnesty International is calling for, a global arms embargo on the government to stop the flow of weapons.
What are some of the other priorities that Amnesty has made? the demands that are being placed on the international community here. Has the international community responded in a way that you feel is responsible here in terms of doing all they can to quell the rising violence in Syria?
No, the international community has fallen far short of what can be done. The U.N. Security Council needs to stop dithering. The Russian and Chinese governments need to stop shielding the Syrian government by using their veto power to block U.N. Security Council action. But then on top of that, Western governments and other governments at the U.N. and U.N. Security Council level also haven't taken the step of calling for the entire matter of the atrocities and human rights violations in Syria to be sent to the International Criminal Court. And Amnesty International wants to see actual global International Criminal Court investigations that have the force of international law so that the people behind much of the violence are prosecuted. Right now, the international community hasn't been doing that and pushing for that. And so as a result, we have this climate of impunity.
And what role has the Obama administration played in this rising violence we've seen in Syria over these last 16 months?
Well, the Obama administration, certainly by calling on the Syrian government to stand down from the violence, by being very critical of the Russian government's arms transfers to Syria, has played a constructive role in that regard. But the Obama administration hasn't done a number of things as well. I mean, for one thing, they haven't called for the International Criminal Court to take up the matter, which is something that the UN Security Council needs to do. Since Syria is not a party to the International Criminal Court, the UN Security Council has to say to the International Criminal Court, you can investigate before the ICC can do that. And so the Obama administration hasn't called for that. Part of the reason might be that the United States, of course, isn't even a party to the International Criminal Court, which is a big challenge. So that's one thing that the Obama administration can do. You know, globally, there needs to be an arms embargo on the Syrian government, and there also needs to be a freeze on the assets of the senior leadership of the Syrian government, including Mr. Bashar al-Assad himself. None of these things have happened yet, and the violence continues as a result.
Why do you think the international community, including the Obama administration, has been so cautious here? Can it really all be blamed on Russia and China and the opposition they've expressed in the UN Security Council?
I think it's certainly fair to put a lot of the blame on the Russian and Chinese governments, who have been the primary forces as obstacles. Other governments initially blocked UN Security Council action as well, but they have since changed their positions or have rotated off the UN Security Council. But Russia and China, of course, are permanent members. But I don't think you can put all the blame on them, because calling for a global arms embargo on the Syrian government, for example, is something that we haven't really heard yet from other countries in a loud volume. We haven't heard other countries call for an end to the impunity by beginning International Criminal Court investigations. Those things haven't happened yet. And certainly, you know, Russia and China aren't the only countries. Russia in particular isn't the only country to be providing weapons and to have provided weapons to Middle East countries and countries elsewhere in the world that have problematic human rights records. You know, the United States is the largest arms exporter in the world. And so all of these may be factors at play.
We're speaking tonight here in Counterpoint with Sanjeev Berry, Amnesty International's Middle East Advocacy Director. And Sanjeev, I wanted to ask you about some concerns you have on the arms flowing to opposition groups, the Free Syrian Army and other factions that are fighting the Syrian government.
Yes, we've received a growing number of reports of human rights abuses in which some of the opposition forces are alleged to have kidnapped or tortured or even killed people that they have considered to be soldiers with the Syrian government or Syrian government-affiliated officials or individuals, and have engaged in human rights violations of that sort. And there are basic rules of war, and the rules of war include not shooting and killing people once they've surrendered or once they've been captured, not torturing them, these sorts of things. And so we've seen increasing reports of that. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, that's important to know. When a government such as the Syrian government is repressing, you know, it seems with impunity, so many sectors of society, you know, what there is an inherent, in the belief of many, a right to armed self-preservation. And I'm wondering how Amnesty views, you know, the right of the oppressed Syrian public to use arms to resist the violence on the part of the state.
Well, Amnesty International's basic position is through the human rights lens and the human rights framework. And what that means is that where there is internal conflict or war, there are human rights rules that are in place. And if combatants are at war with each other, there are a set of things that are not allowed to happen, and that, in fact, rise to the level of war crimes or crimes against humanity if they're done. You know, crimes against humanity are when an armed force or a government intentionally targets large numbers of civilians with violence at a large level. War crimes can occur when you have some of the incidents that I mentioned with the opposition forces, sometimes abducting, capturing, killing, torturing members of the Syrian armed forces or others that they perceive to be allied with the Syrian government. So those are the specific areas that we're concerned about, and that's why our call for an arms embargo is focused on the Syrian government, because as yet we haven't seen or documented the kind of large-scale targeting of civilian populations from the opposition forces that we have definitely seen firsthand on the ground when we sent our researcher into Syria from the Syrian armed forces that are the arms of the state, of the government.
Again, we're talking tonight with Sanjeev Berry, Amnesty International's Middle East Advocacy Director, and we're talking about the grave situation in Syria at present. And Sanjeev, we've discussed on this program the situation in Syria where you have the folks running the government, which are the Alawite minority, really lording over the Sunni majority of the country. And I'm wondering, as you assess what I guess has to be a possible devolution of this conflict into an ethnic conflict, what are your concerns surrounding the sort of divisions in Syrian society between the Alawite and the Sunni communities?
Well, there is definitely, I think, a growing public concern among many scholars and witnesses to the conflict that this could move in the direction of a sectarian or ethnicity-based conflict. That's a real danger. It's currently being fueled by the violence from the Syrian government primarily, and so the challenge is to ramp that violence down immediately so that it doesn't move in that direction.
And what is the best way to do that? I mean, it just seems with access to Syria itself so limited to human rights monitors, anybody from the United Nations and other countries, it seems like a difficult task to have any nation or entity insert itself to make a difference. I mean, I guess that's the big challenge here.
Well, there are a couple of things people can do. I mean, one is at the macro level, the problem that's happening in Syria right now is that it's worse in Syria, but it's also a problem elsewhere, which is the unregulated flow of weapons to very problematic governments and or individuals who then use them against civilians. And so one way to stop that actually is an effort that Amnesty International is engaged in globally, which is to pass an arms trade treaty through the United Nations. Right now, my colleagues from different branches of Amnesty International, I myself work for Amnesty International USA, colleagues from other parts of the world with Amnesty International are in New York right now at the United Nations pushing for an arms trade treaty. And there's active negotiations going on right now. And the public can help, people listening to this call can help by going to the website clickboom.org. That's clickboom.org to send an email to your UN delegates and delegation urging them to support a strong treaty. That's the big picture. Then at the local, when it comes to Syria, if you go to amnestyusa.org/help Syria, you can take action right now to urge the Russian government to stop standing in the way of an end to the violence.
Do you, when you look at Russia in particular, which is a long-running ally of Damascus, do you think they could make a difference just by one phone call to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and say, hey, it's time. Go and make way for, pave the way for a transition government.
You know, it's hard to know exactly how those sort of behind the scenes diplomatic actions are perceived, but certainly when it's come to U.S. relationships with other repressive leaders, that's certainly how it's been described. And so I would certainly suspect that if the Russian government made a significant shift in its posture towards the Syrian government, that the Syrian government would start changing its posture pretty quickly. You know, if the Syrian government ran out of guns, ran out of bullets, ran out of diplomatic cover, then the leadership is going to start changing its posture dramatically, or risk being swept away.
I've also heard it said that because the Alawite minority, which by and large controls important sectors of the government and the military, if this conflict is being viewed under the lens of ethnic conflict, then there may be people among the Alawite minority that believe that if they don't fight to the death, they will be victims and die themselves. So there's been some discussion of creating some kind of safe haven or exit for those government elites from the Alawite community to ensure that they don't feel backed into a corner, that they have to fight to the death or be killed themselves in an eventual takeover by the Sunni majority. I don't know if that's overstating the case, but how do you read that kind of analysis?
Well, that's a good question, and I think it gets into the knot of human rights concerns, because on the one hand, there is that line of argument that says, you know, if you let the bad leadership or the bad actors escape, then they go retire, you know, somewhere else, and the country moves on. On the other hand, that sort of an action can maintain or fuel a continued climate of impunity. You know, as we've seen in a country not too far away, the country of Egypt, even though Mubarak is long gone, Hosni Mubarak, the former dictator, the military leaders are still very much in place and, you know, took the steps of disbanding the parliament. And so a climate of impunity can sometimes result if we're purely focused on letting bad actors or bad individuals have an exit strategy instead of uniformly calling across the board for the application of human rights law so that, you know, if people engage in war crimes or crimes against humanity, they risk prosecution and they risk spending the rest of their life in jail. That also signals to the entire country that behavior has to change no matter which side of the conflict you're on.
Again, we're speaking tonight with Sanjiv Berry, Amnesty International's Middle East Advocacy Director. And Sanjiv, what do you think about the advisability of armed intervention here? We saw not that long ago that the Obama administration worked with their NATO allies to provide air support to the Libyan rebels that were fighting to overthrow the government of Muammar Gaddafi. Is there anything that makes sense in terms of armed international intervention in Syria that would work at this point?
Well, there's a spectrum of outcomes when it comes to recent U.S. interventions in the Middle East and North Africa, or U.S.-backed interventions. Libya is frequently pointed to by many as a quote-unquote positive example, but if you look now at Libya, the country is ruled by a patchwork of perhaps hundreds of local militias, and there are as many as 7,000 Libyans, you know, being held in these private or government detention centers, many of whom have experienced torture, etc. There's even a town of 30,000 people who are of the darker-skinned Tuareg ethnic group, who were all forced out of the town by a rival militia that was anti-Gaddafi and that considered that town to be pro-Gaddafi. So Libya is facing some huge human rights challenges, even though Gaddafi has gone from power. But a far worse example, of course, is the entire disaster and humanitarian catastrophe that ensued in Iraq after the U.S.-led invasion. So invasions and military engagements of that nature have all kinds of outcomes that are unpredictable. And the best approach to stopping the violence in Syria is to stop the flow of arms into the country and to begin a global human rights investigation through the International Criminal Court. If the Assad government fears that it's going to run out of bullets, it's going to run out of guns, if it fears that its senior leadership is cut off from their sources of wealth, these kinds of things have a greater likelihood of reducing the conflict than the unpredictable, sometimes, process of rolling the dice and having an international military engagement.
So, just a final question for you here. We're in the midst of a presidential election campaign in the United States, and I'm wondering how you think the pressures of a political campaign is affecting decisions with regard to Syria on the part of the Obama administration.
That's a very good question, because obviously presidential campaigns frequently hinge around perceptions of very basic, you know, characteristics. Is somebody decisive? Is somebody not decisive? And the decisive thing to do at this particular point in time is to be extraordinarily explicit about a global arms embargo on the Syrian government and a freeze on the Syrian government's access to global resources. And I think if a political leader does that and endorses that, then you're going to start to see positive outcomes.
So you think that there's some hesitancy on the part of the Obama administration to engage in that for out of concern that, let's say, Barack Obama's opponent in the election, Republican nominee or soon-to-be nominee, Mitt Romney, would be critical from the right? I mean, it's hard to know how this will play out. But any guesses there?
It is hard to know how it'll play out, and I think it's also in the heat of an election. Sometimes pressures can be brought to bear that lead to problematic outcomes, and my personal hope is that people in the United States, as well as our elected officials and those officials who are seeking office, will look at the situation and keep in mind that the core interest is the human rights of the Syrian people, and that needs to be looked out for above any electoral considerations or political considerations, those sorts of things.
All right, Sanjiv, thank you so much for, you know, taking the time to really get into a lot of the angles of this tragedy unfolding in Syria. And leave our listeners, if you would, with a website at Amnesty where people can get more information and reports that I know your folks in the field provide on the website as well.
Absolutely. Two websites, amnestyusa.org/helpsyria. And then if you want to help regulate the arms trade globally so that other Assads don't get their hands on these kinds of weapons, you can go to clickboom.org.
That's click as in clickboom, B-O-O-M, .org?
Yeah.
Okay. Again, thanks, Sanjiv. Appreciate your hard work on this issue and many others, and thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Take care. Bye-bye. That's Sanjiv Berry, Amnesty International's Middle East Advocacy Director, Amnesty International USA, /helpsyria, or clickboom.org, two sites suggested by Sanjiv there.